You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, October 4th, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, David Dayan of Fire Dog Lake News on all the protests that, essentially the movement of bank accountability that has led us to what we now see as a full-blown movement in Occupy Wall Street. He'll also give us an update on what's happening holding those banks accountable. He'll be speaking to us from the Campaign for America's Future conference, which I will be broadcasting live from tomorrow briefly. Today is going to be the next 36 hours of my life are going to be insane. Just absolutely insane. I know you're dying to hear about it. We'll talk about that a little bit later in the program. Also joining us on the program, Mike Stark from Truth Ticker, which he has been, I've mentioned this in the past, he has been basically creating an organization explicitly to make Rush Limbaugh look like an idiot in front of his own audience, and he is becoming more and more successful at it. Very excited to talk to Mike Stark. And we will get to those guests in just a moment. In the meantime, ladies and gentlemen, a couple of stories I didn't talk about yesterday. I'm going to try and get there. Like I say, the next 36, 48 hours is going to be crazy. Tomorrow I'm going to be in Washington, D.C. I am getting in tonight at about 11:30 in the morning. I've got a 7:30 a.m. panel, which you can see on Free Speech TV. I'm going to try and capture that, and we will provide that as an offering to our members, presuming that Matt wants to wake up that early in the morning and record it. I will try and record it. And also I'm going to try and record the other panel I'm going to be on at 8:45. And provide that to members. And then we're going to do the show tomorrow. I may start early and maybe one of those jobbies because I got to jump, get back on a train. I've mentioned in the past that I need to do other work to support this quasi-habit, quasi-job of doing a daily podcast. I am doing, I'm recording another session of Bob's Burgers. That cartoon on Fox, very political, at least my participation in it, not so much the actual product. And I'm doing a couple of guest spots in some BBC panel show. I'm not even sure. BBC-A. I don't think it's political. I think it's comedy. I'm not sure. And on Thursday, we're going to be broadcasting live with the guys from Citizen Radio and gals, I should say, from Occupy Wall Street. An exciting week. Meanwhile, yesterday, and I want to be very careful here as we discuss this. Yesterday, I was on Dylan Radigan's program, and often, as is the case, we are joined by a so-called expert, and we have the opportunity to ask them questions. Now, longtime listeners of this program will understand the significance of my sitting across the table from Tom Friedman, people who read FUBAR, America's right-wing
FUBAR, nightmare. America's right-wing nightmare.
We'll also know my feelings of Tom Friedman. He is a neoliberal. There are some positions he has that I agree with. I think he has a weird sort of disposition to talking about rickshaw drivers and all the servants that he has. He's married to a billionaire. He is a billionaire, I presume, himself, at least in market value. Maybe that's down. Maybe they lost a lot of money. But I'm quite sure he's still quite comfortable. And he also was quite famous for advocating for on behalf of the Iraq invasion for different reasons than George Bush. But in my estimation, he was one of the most important people to come out in favor of Iraq is the Iraq illegal Iraq invasion and occupation, insofar as convincing moderates and liberals to go along with the plan. And someone pointed out to me that I had a question for him during this exchange where Dylan Radigan had asked him, you know, and Dylan has been, I'll tell you, he is on fire with this Occupy Wall Street stuff. I mean, he is in love with those people. I think it's just a matter of weeks before he's sleeping out there. Maybe it could be a matter of days. And Radigan had asked Thomas Friedman a question about, don't we have a problem, essentially, with the with money in politics? And Friedman sort of tried to pivot the question to about whether or not banks are behaving well. And it's true, banks and Wall Street are not behaving well. But we have a fundamental problem where money, where the moneyed elite, where the 1% in this country is dictating the politics and policies of our government to favor themselves, as one might expect. But it's coming at the expense of the other 99%. And I asked Thomas Friedman a question in that regard. And I think I'm not going to make a big stink of this. I couldn't quite figure out how to articulate the dynamic between the moneyed elite and the rest of us. And the best I could come up with, I don't know how I ended up getting that phrase, but well, let's play this clip. And longtime listeners will, I think, appreciate what I'm trying to say here. This is number two.
I don't have. Do you want me to? Do you want me to play the what with you or
no, number two? Oh wait, no, I'm sorry. Excuse me, number three. Apologies.
What we've gotten away from here in the current environment.
Sam? Yeah, I mean, I just to carry Dylan's point a little further. I mean, isn't the problem? I mean, your policy suggestions are I would agree with, but isn't the problem that we can't get those passed because we have such income disparity and we now have a power disparity that is so tilted to the wealthy in this country, to the moneyed interests? They are saying essentially, and you know, we're not out of that scary period yet. We still have millions upon millions of people who are unemployed. Don't we have a situation, poverty? Don't we have a situation where essentially the wealthy elite are basically telling the 99% of us, you know, suck on this.
Right.
This is the way it's going
to
be.
I think that you know, we've tried to get money out of politics through the whole McCain-Feingold thing. I mean, to me, the big question is.
Yep.
I mean, how do you revive that? Ultimately, the Supreme Court is the one that knocked that down, okay? And so, you know, there's a comment that Jagdish Bhagwati made during the height of the subprime crisis, which I really liked. He was talking about what happened, basically, to our financial industry. He said, we went from an industry that was really designed to do, to finance creative destruction, new industries replacing old industries, and has ended up, basically, doing destructive creation. And that's really, I think, the change that people feel over the last few years.
All right, so there it is. And we're going to take a break. I'm going to talk to David Dayen. If I'm being a little bit obtuse for you, maybe you go on the blog at majority.fm and people will explain to you the relevance of my phrasing there. I don't know. It was weird. Well, I'll talk about it more in the better half of the program. In the meantime, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to David Dayan, Fire Dog League News. All right, folks, Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure, as always, to welcome to this program David Dayan. He is the editor, the guy who runs the Fire Dog Lake news desk and seems to be in 5,000 places at once. David, you are in the halls of our Capitol, aren't you?
I am in the halls of the Hart Senate Office Building. You might say that I am occupying about 2 square feet of the Hart Senate Office Building right now, and I'm not leaving until this interview is done.
I appreciate that, and I know all of our audience appreciates your hanging with us. All right, let's talk about. There's a couple of things I want to talk to you about, and let's start. Let's go from the specific to the more general. First off, there was big news the other day about California announcing they're not going to play with this mortgage deal too. Will you just give us a background on that?
Sure. Your listeners may know that there is this attempted 50-state attorney general investigation of big banks for the foreclosure processing problems that have hounded them for quite a long time. And this started a year ago, and it was supposed to be an investigation followed by some manner of penalty or indictment or whatever. Instead, the investigation was sort of skipped, and they moved right to a negotiated settlement. The negotiations have been going on for, close to a year, and nothing has been decided yet. But one by one, some of the attorneys general who think that their job description is not to give out get-out-of-jail-free cards to banks, but actually to work for their constituents, and if wrongdoing was done in terms of forgeries and backdated documents and false documentation to essentially steal homes by the big banks, then it's their responsibility to actually investigate that. So led by the Attorney General of New York, Eric Schneiderman, he started an investigation, said he would not put together a settlement. He would not agree to a broad release of liability for the banks without a serious investigation to look at the depths of the crimes that have been committed. Only then will we know, could you put a number on how much money would have to be given as restitution for these crimes. So Schneiderman sparked a movement, and it's a movement that was from many different angles, be it direct action, be it progressive groups signing on, pressuring their attorneys general to not sign on to this thing until there was an actual investigation. From all levels, this thing has grown and grown and grown. About six, it started with, up until Friday, six attorneys general who backed out of the talks. And then on Friday afternoon, Kamala Harris, the Attorney General of California, who had been getting enormous pressure from a lot of different places in California, a lot of housing advocates, a lot of progressive groups, said she would not be party to the settlement. And this is big, big news. First of all, you can't do a settlement. You can't do one without New York, but you really can't do one without California, which has something like 2 million foreclosures in the queue. Second of all, Kamala Harris is someone who was a high-profile surrogate for Barack Obama during the 2008 election. This is someone who is very tied to the Obama administration. Someone who has higher aspirations for higher office, maybe even working at the Justice Department. And so for her to back off is a major, major moment because the Justice Department and the Obama administration was certainly wanting a quick settlement to go through so that they could say that they got something for homeowners, some mortgage relief, and they put this behind them. So the fact that Harris pulled away is a major progressive victory. I would actually say it's the biggest progressive victory in terms of, you know, stopping this thing that the biggest interest group in America, the finance lobby, and the Obama administration was pushing for. I'd say it's the biggest thing since 2006 when Ned Lamont beat Joe Lieberman.
Yeah, I think, you know, this is why I wanted to talk to you about this. And this is, I want to just make it clear to our audience, this is, I don't believe this is hyperbole at all. People have to understand that they were, the administration was pressuring Eric Schneiderman through both the Justice Department and through Daugherty, right? Sean Daugherty, is that his name, from HUD?
Sean Donovan, the Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, who used to be a HUD, a federal house, a housing regulator in New York City.
So there was intense, right. So there's intense pressure from the administration, and then a close ally of the administration essentially gives up the ghost in California. And now the thing that I also wanted to talk to you about is that I think, you know, what's happening on Wall Street, while it may not be directly tied in terms of the people, and maybe it is in some respects, and you might know better than I do, but I think what people are not fully aware of is the immense pressure that is was pushed on put on the California Attorney General, and that has been going on in the background for the past couple of years. It has not gotten the same type of publicity. It is working a slightly different game, not necessarily an inside game, but sort of an outside inside game. Characterize that and characterize it in relationship to Occupy Wall Street.
Yeah, well, as I put it today, these bank accountability movements, which I'll mention in a moment, sort of laid the kindling for the fire that has been sparked by the Occupy Wall Street protests. I mean, they're starting all the way back in 2009, you know, in reaction to the financial crisis and the extraordinary support that the federal government gave the banks to prop them up quickly, but did not give to people who were suffering from the you know, the problem that was created in terms of the Great Recession. There has been a very targeted, activist, direct action protest all over the country for you know, starting in Chicago at the American Bankers Association, where they had 10,000 people in the streets, called the Showdown in America. Just this past May on Wall Street, there was a 20,000 person protest that nobody seems to remember. It was like, you know, 5 months before Occupy Wall Street, there were 20,000 people on Wall Street that were protesting. Some of those people that were doing that protesting are you know, leaders, to the extent there is a leadership in the Occupy Wall Street movement. And I wrote a post about this. It was at news.firedoglegs.com. There are countless examples of these direct action groups like the New Bottom Line, groups like National People's Action, Refund California, Take Back Boston, Showdown in America. I mean, I could go on and on and on. These things did not, as you said, get a whole lot of major media traction. But the people who were being confronted by this certainly knew what was going on. And it's sort of, you know, Occupy Wall Street comes out of that same conversation, that same spirit. There was something in the air, and it was going to take, you know, something that galvanized the public to, you know, have it catch fire. And that's what we're seeing. I mean, that's what we're seeing in Lower Manhattan right now and in Wall Street. And I'm here in Washington for these Take Back America. It's called the Take Back the American Dream Conference, which I believe you're going to be at tomorrow.
Yep.
And you will see that this has really energized these conference goers, that they are, you know, that they were, this American Dream, Take Back the American Dream conference was sort of operating also on a parallel track with this thing called the American Dream Movement. Van Jones has wanted to put together a contract for the American Dream and sort of push on a jobs agenda rather than a cuts agenda and all of these different types of things. And they create, you know, what he likes to call a liberal tea party. Well, I mean, that's happening sort of in an organic sense. And it's almost that the script has been rewritten at the last minute for this conference to incorporate the Occupy Wall Street energy and to build off it, not necessarily to co-opt it, but to say that, yeah, we have had this we have wanted this to happen for some time, and we want to support these efforts, build off these efforts, and create the conditions where we can change the conversation in Washington.
Yeah, you know, let's talk about this a little bit, because it's fascinating to me. I have a theory as to why Occupy Wall Street is garnering more attention than some of these other actions did. And I think, you know, part of it is frankly Tony Baloney, Mason, those women. And I think the other part of it is that the level of commitment in having people sleep outside, I think, is something that is just – it takes it to another level. To me, it's the equivalent of – and this is the only equivalency – you know, I think the whole equivalency with the Tea Party movement is, frankly – even, you know, in terms of what Van Jones has been trying to create, is silly, because the Tea Party movement was a rebranded effort of people who were simply the Republican base, and they were rebranded with a lot of branding money. I mean, from the right wing. There was nothing about that was really a movement. It was simply the Republican base. We have empirical data now to prove that, you know, from studies that have been done by Notre Dame and Harvard professors. But I think that from a publicity standpoint, from how people are paying attention, sleeping out in the park shows a level of a commitment that would the only equivalent on the Tea Party side was them showing up with guns at meetings. You know, like, honestly, I mean, I think, like, you know, the way the media interpreted, these guys are showing up with guns. They mean business. Well, on the left, you had people doing almost the opposite. We're going to subject ourselves physically to a significant amount of discomfort to show our commitment.
Right. I think that's true. I think similarly, the other big movement that sort of caught fire from just sort of one action like this was in Wisconsin. And similarly there, they camped out and occupied the Capitol Rotunda. So, you know, I talked to someone from the high-level union official from the Wisconsin Education Association today, and she said, yeah, it's all the same stuff. So we're all talking the same language. Whether the issues are slightly different is immaterial. It's we're talking about this frustration of an economy that works for only a select few, and the rest of us kind of get screwed. So yes, I agree with you, and I definitely think that the Tony Baloney thing, it certainly would not have garnered maybe some of the same notoriety without that sense of injustice that you have to add to it. And the cops sort of working to protect the, you know, to stop the barbarians at the gate or something.
Right.
You know, the fact that it's in New York City and people from the Washington Corridor, the Northeast, the Sella Line can come down and be at the protest and do their field work, their Mutual of Omaha field work, I think also helps. That it's planned, it's predictable, and they can go down there and write their stories on it, and give their own impressions. You know, if this was just Occupy Utah, it would be slightly different because people wouldn't be able to just sort of get there quickly.
Right. No, of course, you got to be near the media center. And the other point, I think, which is so effective about this is that implicit in its, you know, the hashtag, the name of it, is it really is. Whether, you know, specifically, maybe too specifically or not, it is focusing on, frankly, an adversary. You know, in without Scott Walker, there is no protest. I mean, without Scott Walker having a physicality in which to focus on, there is no nothing happening in Wisconsin. I think the same here. I mean, frankly, that's been one of the questions I had very early on for Van Jones. Who's the enemy here? And, you know, I think one of the things that's nice about what's happening with Occupy Wall Street, it's forcing the more the closer. I don't want to say the establishment the establishment adversarial groups. I don't know how to really categorize them, but the more institutionalized movements.
Sure. It's the establishment liberals, the progressive organizations, the point and click activists, the unions, that too. Yeah, I agree with you. It's forcing them into a more adversarial position. And what you say about finding an enemy is very important. And it baffles me that we're having a conversation, some people at least are having a conversation about, but we don't know what they're mad about, you know? We don't know their list of grievances and everything. You know, it's called Occupy Wall Street.
Right.
Yeah, they're on Wall Street. Do you need more than that?
Right. That's what I was saying. Every TV appearance I'm on is like, this is not Occupy the Natural Museum of History. This is not Occupy Central Park. You know, what more do you need at that point? Tell me, let's talk about this for a minute. I know you got to jump and just, you know, give me one last question. Because you and I are in the same conversations on certain email lists, and some are more establishment oriented than others. And much of the list that I'm on that involve more establishment liberals, there has been, you know, it's less and less because it's becoming less and less, you know, deniable but there has been that sort of reactions that range from, we don't know what they're demanding, which I think is actually a strength of this movement, frankly.
Right.
It would be a shame. It's too bad they're not dressed better. Why do they have to have drum circles? It's not going to convince anybody in the middle of the country. Let me ask you this. One, why do you think it's to the extent that you do, why do you think it's advantageous that they don't have demands? And two, who in the middle of the country are we supposed to be convincing, and what is the value of it?
Right. As far as a list of demands, the idea that it's impossible to come up with demands on bank accountability and restructuring the economy so it's, you know, prosperity is broadly shared rather than held in the hands of a select few. The idea that there are no solutions that we have talked about for decades is just silly. We know the demands. Like, so they're not checking the specific box. They're not saying that we need to lower the capital gains tax rate or raise it from 15 to 23%, but they should say 24%. Who cares? I mean, this lays the groundwork for a broader conversation. It's not something, you know, that you ever heard from these Tea Party protests at the very beginning. You never heard, well, we don't know specifically if they want government to be 16% of GDP or 17% of GDP. So this is a major problem with their movement. You know, that's just not how movements are built. They're built on ideas, and they're built on perspectives, and they're built on conversations and narratives.
And frankly,
there's
anger.
No reason.
And anger. What? You know, on anger. I mean, you know, like at the end
on
of the day,
frustration. Absolutely.
It is not the responsibility of the people in that park to provide policy prescriptions for our elite. It is the elite to realize they've got a problem, because there are people who are willing to sleep outside for an extended period of time because they're pissed about what's going on in the country.
Absolutely. I mean, I think almost more powerful than, and this may just be me, but more powerful than the Occupy Wall Street movement is its companion, We Are the 99% Tumblr website, which just is testimony. I mean, it just gives descriptions of the horrible conditions that people have had to live through. People who played by the rules, worked hard, did everything right, and cannot get by because of the way the structures are set up in this economy. So, you know, that right there, I think adds, it's just almost more impactful to me. It's an incredible work of you know, just testimony and journalism in a wonderful way.
And what about this argument that we need to convince, these people, they're dressed funny. They listen, they like drums.
How should I answer that? I'll answer this with, at this conference and some of the people that we've heard from. And I've heard from people from all over the country. And in fact, it seems a little more geographically diverse this year than it has in previous years. And people are coming in. There was a panel that I wrote about this banker accountability movement. It's kind of been happening parallel to the Occupy Wall Street protests and for a long, long time. And one kid got up there and he said, you know, and this is very youth-driven, of course. Let's not forget that. And they have had, they are sort of seeing a life of no opportunity right now. And so I don't think it's hard to convince, I don't care where you're from. If you're a young person that just got out of college, has mounds of student loan debt and no prospects, I don't think it's hard to convince you that something is fundamentally going wrong in the country. This guy said, we've grown up in this era where we expect a certain political powerlessness, that we don't feel like our opinions matter in the grand scheme of things. And we were told that the apex of political, of progressive political thought and movement was the Obama campaign, he said. And now all my Facebook friends, this is a student organizer from Occidental College, and he said, now all my Facebook friends, everyone 18 to 20 years old that's on my Facebook page is telling me they want to go to an occupation. So I think this has tapped into a general sense of political powerlessness, political helplessness, and the idea that we all have that something has gone very, very wrong in this country, unless you're privileged enough to work on Wall Street or you know, be the son or daughter of some rich scion. It's a problem of inequality. It's a problem of social mobility, and it's just a fundamental problem of an economy that doesn't work. And so, you know, I think that's a broadly acceptable message. You know, I was talking to someone that said, you know, I mean, in the '60s we did this, but there was a backlash, and this. You know, this ended up not working, and the hard hats went down to protest and beat the kids. You know, the difference there is that in the '60s it was a movement, an anti-war movement, and that's tied up with all of these ideas of American exceptionalism and
it was anti-war. It was also civil rights, and it was about emancipation for different groups. Well, I think fundamentally, yeah, there's two things that have happened differently. And we got just a minute here. There's two things that are different. Mm-hmm. One is that that cleave that took place back then between the unions and the protest movement. Yeah. I think it's more or less gone because A, unions have changed. Society has changed. The issues of...
And they're suffering through the same things that the kids down there are suffering.
Exactly. And they're going to show up Wednesday, and that's going to be really the really exciting day to see how many tens of thousands are going to be there. David Dayan, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you.
All right, folks. We got to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Mike Stark of TruthTicker.com. We'll be right back after this. right, folks, we are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. And, you know, ladies and gentlemen, it's not just about there's many, many facets to what's going on to promote a progressive agenda. And coming from radio, I know the power of right-wing radio. In fact, I think I know it better than most, except for my buddy Mike Stark. You may remember him from Calling All Wingnuts. Now his site is truthticker.com. Mike, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks, sir. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Now, explain to people, and I know that I've mentioned it to people on this show about 3 or 4 months ago when I think I first heard that you were doing this, but tell us what you've been up to.
Well, I've been recruiting people and training them to call into right-wing talk radio shows, say something honest, let me know when they did it so I can go and grab the clip and we can post it up at truthticker.com and other places like Daily Ghost and Huffington Post and just get it out there. Essentially what we're trying to do is get more liberals calling into right-wing talk radio, get more truth out, and if the talkers aren't going to allow us to do that, then we just want to be most disruptive force we can be, because right-wing propaganda has gone on way too long. It's way too powerful.
And it's gone on for too long being uncontested, not just, and you know, we have situations like where Media Matters will take a clip and then present it to people who already know that Rush Limbaugh is a nut job. But there's only one way to make that case to the people who actually listen to Limbaugh. Now, I want to play this clip. This is Rush Limbaugh after getting off the phone with one of your trained callers. Here it is, line number five.
I get a guy who's essentially calling me from a blog, trying to simply score some political points. He's not interested in what's right or wrong. This guy's just a partisan hack trying to counter the effective dissemination of information on this program. And, of course, it's always going to fail. We're rooted in the truth here. Their leader would face a landslide defeat if the election were today. So, of course, they're going to start calling this program and trying to counterbalance what's happening here. We're just way too effective. That's why I'm going to waste time talking with the guy.
Now, that is Limbaugh explaining to his audience why he didn't let this caller speak and make his point. Mike, I think skeptical people will be like, oh, you know, Limbaugh's just dealing with it. This is actually good for his program. But it isn't, is it?
I don't think it is. I mean, he's had to take 90 minutes in the last week to, just really go off the rails, railing against what he calls seminar callers, people that call it. And honestly, I mean, I think anybody with two brain cells thrown together is going to understand that he's not responding to the substance of anything anyone's saying. He's responding to the fact that we got on the air and we said something honest, and he just didn't like it. My callers are awesome. They're doing a great job asking people on these shows to go out and Google things for yourself, get off the radio dial, for more sources of information than just this guy. So, I mean, I don't know how much we've splintered his audience so far. I wouldn't even go so far to suggest that we have. But I think with a sustained effort, with the number of callers we're bringing on board, we can really be a disruptive force.
Yeah, let me make this, you know, let me give you my perspective on this as someone who, did national radio for 6 or 7 years. I still do, but we don't take calls on Ring of Fire, sadly. The repeated, you know, I don't think you've changed anybody's minds. However, at this point, the more and he cannot avoid addressing this fact. The more he has to deal with what you guys are doing, the more he has to make excuses, eventually a veneer gets sort of shredded off of him. Now, you know, we've talked about this in the past that when I was living full time upstate, I would call your buddy Andrew Wilkow, who you used to harass. We both have this sort of love of going after right wing talk radio hosts. And I am convinced, you know, knowing at least what I was sensitive to, and to a certain extent, you're as much messing with him and getting under his skin and messing with his head as you are affecting his audience. And that is almost even better, because long term, he's got to get more and more defensive. He's got to take a different posture in the way that he propagandizes. And it's going to undercut what he's trying to do. And it's going to make him more rabid, more fringe, more paranoid as an individual. And that can't help but come out.
He'll discredit himself over time. I mean, I don't know if you remember the Bill O'Reilly Fox News police force. I'm sure you remember it, actually.
Yes, of course.
You know, when he had threatened callers, you know, I'm going to send the Fox News police to your house if you keep calling me and saying things I don't like you saying. I mean, it's just absolutely ridiculous. That thing busted out all over the place. Howard Stern was using it in his bumpers for months after that. And, you know, that's one way that they end up discrediting themselves. The other thing is, the more time they spend responding to us or just having us on the air, it's less time they can spend, you know, delivering a new set of lies.
That's right.
So there's a lot of advantages to this. And if any of your listeners want to get involved, have them email me. My email is stark.m@gmail.com.
All right, we will put that on the...
Or as many people...
And go to truthticker.com. You have a contact sheet there as well, yes?
Yes.
Okay, yeah, it's truthticker.com. I know there are people who listen to this program who would enjoy it. And, of course, you know, Mike can set you up and figure out a way of recording it. And I love what you do, and I really do think there is value in this. And, of course, you know, the other element is, at one point, they're going to start taking less phone calls, which is also going to mess with their program. I mean, I think it's quite wonderful. And I also want to say at this point, if there are conservatives out there who think this is fundamentally unfair, and how would I like it if they kept calling into my program spouting conservative talking points, the number is 646-257-3920. Please do. And never, ever, ever stop. 646-257-3920. I welcome every conservative caller out there. We take calls every day starting at this point in the show, and I will take your calls. If you don't feel comfortable saying to our screener you're a conservative, don't. You can lie, or you can say you're a conservative. If you say you're a conservative, I guarantee you'll be the first person I take. If you don't say you're a conservative, I will get to you. Sometimes we don't even screen calls. We just pick them up. And so I may say, who is this? What you're doing is great, Mike. And I want to encourage everybody, head over to truthticker.com. If you want to get involved, get involved. If you want to support what Mike is doing, support what he's doing. I think what you're doing is wonderful, and I always enjoy it, and I always get a laugh too.
I'll keep it up, and I'll keep letting you know when we hit pay dirt with these guys.
All right, great. Well, thank you so much. Mike Stark, folks, from truthticker.com.
Take care, Sam.
Take it easy. We've got to take a break and head to the better half of the show. Ladies and gentlemen, you can join us for the better half of the show by joining at majority.fm. I had an email from a 15-year-old who cannot afford a subscription, doesn't want to bother his mom. I'm going to send you one, buddy. I don't have time to read the email today. I'll try and read it tomorrow or Thursday or Friday or something like that. But you will get one. I am sorry I've been a little bit late in getting to it. If you have a problem affording a membership, email me. I will get to it, I promise, and we will work something out. If you don't have a problem affording a membership and you want to support and make sure that the show continues and... Or you just want the bonus material that you get every day. It's not bonus, it's almost a better material. Then become a member at majority.fm. Podcast awards are closed. The nominations are closed. We're going to find out in a week. But you can always give us a rating on iTunes, which is a big help for the show. And, of course, buying your junk through our Amazon link, we get a small kickback from that. That's always wonderful, even though that company is horrible in many respects. A lot of corporations are, folks. But one company that you will never feel bad, and I will never feel bad or have any ambivalence about telling you to go and patronize, and that is JustCoffee.coop. Coffee, tea, chocolate, fair trade, organic if you want it. It's a co-op. You get 10% off with the coupon code MAJORITY. And then, of course, donateyouraccount.com/MAJORITYFM. Spread the word. All right. See you on the better half of the program.